Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 55, section 3, which is old single column, page 624. All right, as I pointed out in anticipation at the end of the previous session, they started us out with those two sections to satiate our curiosity about personal issues, you know, a little bit more specifically, before they got into the general issue of the nature of things on a sphere of enlightened life. As you can tell by the title of this section, they're now going to move into those general details. It's in the context, as we saw in those previous sections, of you have an increasing number of people that are definitely making some progress with their psychic circles, or moving up the cosmic levels. They're actually getting diffusion during their mortal life, but it is a sublime mortal life relative to anything we can imagine, and it, you know, it's pushing up to 500 years long. So it's a long, very transcendent mortal life, and yet we saw that it's not like everyone is fusing. And as we'll see as we get into the very beginning of this section, there are some things in play that are not part of your imaginings of heaven on earth. Reality is more real than imagination. And we're about to see that a little bit. So, when people speak of the golden ages, we're going to learn the relativity of that. In some ways, yes, very, very transcendent. So much so you can't even remotely imagine it. It's so transcendent. And yet in other ways, you can imagine it. So we're going to see how that plays together. And then also, as I teased last time, we've got coming up a little treat that they throw into here. After this first paragraph. So let's get that first one first here.
Section 3, the Golden Ages. During this age of light and life, the world increasingly prospers under the fatherly rule of the planetary sovereign. By this time, the worlds are progressing under the momentum of one language, one religion, and on normal spheres, one race. But this age is not perfect. These worlds still have well-appointed hospitals, homes for the care of the sick. There still remain the problems of caring for accidental injuries and the inescapable infirmities attendant upon the decrepitude of old age and the disorders of senility. Disease has not been entirely vanquished. Neither have the earth animals been subdued in perfection. But such worlds are like paradise in comparison with the early times of primitive man during the pre-planetary prince age. You would instinctively describe such a realm could you be suddenly transported to a planet in this stage of development as heaven on earth.
Okay, so you've got that last statement about, in many ways you would think heaven on earth. And as they pointed out, beyond anything you've ever imagined, even in some respects. But there's a whole bunch of little points that they bind together here in this paragraph. Start out with that initial statement about increasingly prospers under the fatherly rule of the planetary sovereign. Just a good point to remind you. You may recall back, let's see, what paper is that? In paper 51, section 6, remember how they gave us that hierarchy of fathers, of universe fathers. You have your biologic father, obviously, first, followed by, as they say there, the father of the realm, the planetary Adam. You know, and then heading on up the hierarchy with the system sovereign, etc. But the father of the realm was the planetary Adam. And so you know, if you're remembering that, that hierarchy precisely, as you see this fatherly rule of the planetary sovereign, that should, you know, catch your eye. One of the things that happens over the course of the unfolding ages of light and life is a transition in that regard. Now, eventually, the Adam and Eve are going to leave. Yeah. You know, not only the father of the realm, but the mother of the realm. And, so they're just kind of reminding you what ought to be pretty obvious. At least in terms of the father of the realm, to figure out the mother of the realm issue later, but the father of the realm, has an obvious immediate person that can kind of take over as a very direct sort of downstepped expression of the system sovereign, that next father up, right, as Lenonadec. Now, of course, in our case, you know, it'll be Melchizedek, but nonetheless, just notice that little detail. So that's just hinting. I bet as I start reading forward in this, I'm going to see some transition where the longtime father of the realm is handing off, you know, that role, and definitely that is the case. Now, when they say progressing under the momentum of one language, one religion, and on normal spheres, one race. Just a little point up front here. You'll see them coming back to it later. In the civilization papers up in part three, they remind you of some of the mechanics of this a little bit more. But the only way you get a world to one religion is when you finally have the whole world up above religion. You know, step one is to get above religion, get a worldwide philosophy established, and then approach religion anew from the top down. You know, that's how you achieve that one religion. You know, right now, there's it's very trivial to recognize that we're not in a top-down mode, that we're in a bottom-up mode. You know, just the coexist bumper sticker says it all, right? How many symbols are on that coexist bumper sticker? Not one, right? We have, you know, the multi-threaded bottom-up phenomenon, circus, of which all has to be transcended, right? I mean, the delusion of that coexist bumper sticker. There is no harmonizing that. You have to transcend all of that. That's all scaffolding. Now, that will get, each of those threads gets a particular group up. You have a kindred spirit that is in common amongst all those different threads, right? But that's just a potential. That's not the actuality of one religion. That's just a potential for one religion, because it's the potential to take each of those threads up to philosophy. In a super additive consequence of relationship to true science, right, and leverage up to that one worldwide synchronization with the cosmos, that one philosophy, the kindred minds of that one philosophy, and then approach religion anew from the top down and get one religion. And so, that's between the lines there of that. Obviously, the more you've transcended the biologic differences, the more you can get to one language, too. We'll talk about that a little bit more ahead a bit here. Okay, you have that, and then they say, but. so they tee up, and then they say, but. But this age is not perfect. Okay, they give you well-appointed hospitals. You think, there's bound to be accidental injuries. But then they start throwing in the inescapable infirmities attendant upon the decrepitude of old age and the disorders of senility even. Maybe you can handle the decrepitude of old age. When they throw in the next one, you think, Yeah, isn't there some vast science fiction technology in play now, like we always imagine? You know, were those things... No. No. You age. You know, and if you're not fusing during your mortal life, right, you're going to die of old age. You know, and 500 years old, you're going to be decrepit. Right?
I hope so.
Now, you're not going to be as decrepit as we currently imagine, right? Right? You know, it's a little bit more like taking the kind of life spectrum that we recognize now and just spreading it out over 500 years instead of 100 years. You know, it's a little bit more like what you have, right? With a little bit of upstepping, obviously. It's not just simply spreading it out. But right. But you're going to have a tail end, you know, pushing towards 500, where you know, it's like everyone has when they're, you know, when they're pushing toward 100. Okay. Now, obviously, it'll be a lot, better technology so that it won't be simplistic decrepitude, but there will be decrepitude, right? I'm sure you can overcome all kinds of rudimentary physical issues. But one way or another, the body just grinds down, you know?
But Chris, what about people who were born 500 years ago are still on the planet, and everybody since, it's going to get really crowded unless...
Well, again, there's all kinds of population control that comes in and all this sort of stuff. Remember, we're enlightened life now. We're way beyond anything you can even imagine in terms of wisdom and insight.
It's going to have to be limited.
Right. Obviously, if everyone's going to be living 500 years old, you can't be breeding like rabbits.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But that disorders of senility, you know, thing should really, you know, that should really catch you. You know, so that reminds you of when we're trying to attack these problems now, right? You're up against some things that are not going to be trivially solved, right? They're not solved by physics that's completely beyond our imagination, let alone the crude stuff that we're thinking about right now, right? So, you know, that should catch your eye and get you to, you know, to not be improperly idealistic about material possibilities, right? You can make material improvements, advancements, but, right, there are limits. Matter is never going to be spirit substance, right? It's never going to be changeless like spirit substance. Right? It's fundamentally changes. Right? Even the very fancy matter bodies of Havona natives, right, has a process. You know, they don't die of old age and stuff, but it's still, right. I mean, it's material substance. It's not spirit substance, and so it has similar material laws, like the second law of thermodynamics associated with it. Right? You know, you're not going to somehow transcend the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. Entropy is entropy, right? No matter how advanced your technology is. Okay, so, you know, and that separation of the life animation from the dead matter, right? I mean, no physics is ever going to be able to put a wrench on that, you know, and tighten that back up again. I mean, life animation is a completely intangible fact. Right? And you know, no being, even extremely high beings, have any way to take a hold of that. It's not a thing to any being. You know, and so it's this very subtle influence that just slowly backs off from the matter, and okay, that's just that. There's no stopping that. Okay, so that, and then another one. Disease has not been entirely vanquished. So again, to be more, you know, less hopelessly idealistic about these sorts of things. They're throwing these things in for a number of reasons, you know, not just to give you a better sense of what light and life is about, but to help you with truth in general. You know, we're trying to cram all of reality into matter, you know, right now. You know, A lot of people don't even separate mind from matter. So, you know, mind and spirit and everything, and personality and everything has got to all be crammed into matter. And so we have all of these very false ideas when we do that, because there's certain intuitions we have relative to our relationship to spirit that when you cram it into matter, you know, turn matter into a very magical thing that it's not. Okay? And, you know, eliminating disease, even with very advanced technology, you know, like we often imagine, you know, the secondary midwives could set up a hospital tomorrow, you know, and we could walk in the front door and walk out the, you know, the back door with our diseases cured. Well, yeah, you know, in general, but not totally, as they're pointing out here. Even very, very advanced technology still has limits. And they're, you know, we'll have genetics that's resistant to all the basic bacterial and viral things like we should have had and all that, but there's going to be diseases still.
Frail.
Probably if, you know, in ways that we really, we're so crude right now that we don't even recognize some of the diseases you could have if you were a subtler phenomenon, right? You know, none of us would ever die of these diseases because we all die of much cruder things, right? No one dies of getting hit by the little, you know, tiny hammer, you know, the little foam hammer. They, you know, everyone dies because they're hit with a sledgehammer on this planet, right? So, you know, as you go along, you know, you're eliminating the more and more coarse, you know, cruder elements, but that just opens up all the issues of the finer elements and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
It's like cancer wasn't heard that much about 100 years ago.
Right. No one ever got the chance to die of cancer. Right.
If they did.
You died of battle axe. right. Yeah. So, you know, like when we were talking about, you know, using 80 years for that calculation, you know, to end up getting the, you know, an estimate of the age of the finite, you know, how old the super universe level is. You know, 75 years is the longevity of the original Andenites. But, you know, we talked about, I mean, how many actually made it to that inherent longevity, right? I mean, it's, you know, extremely unlikely that very many made it to, you know, 100%. to their full longevity, right? Way too many things that you're going to die of. So life is, you know, their life expectancy and longevity were obviously different, right? Right? As we've improved our science, life expectancy and longevity have gotten, you know, much more equal. They've brought life expectancy up into the, you know, right there basically with what we have innately for a potential lifespan. All right, so all that is challenging us to not think that we're going to, you know, we can have these science fiction futures where no one dies of diseases anymore. I mean, that's not an easy thing to achieve. No science fiction author has even remotely imagined the kind of domain we're talking about here. And then they throw in, of course, as they often do, the earth animals, you know, have not been subdued in perfection. Right? So, you know, you could still get killed by a carnivore or something, you know, or bitten by the wrong insect or spider or something. But you're moving towards something where you've eliminated all animals, you know, that impact humans like that, or you've genetically re-engineered them so they don't impact you like that. Because remember, by the time we're getting to this, it's not just humans, but everything on the planet has been completely, you know, altered genetically. You know, you've got to move the whole planet to light and life, not just humans. You know, every rock and every plant and every animal along with the humans has got to be taken to light and life. Right, so vast genetic engineering, you know, modification of all crops, you know, everything will be genetically engineered.
Weather.
Yeah, you're moving towards a completely artificial thing where it's completely personality managed. Right? Nothing
Lossy
that... well, not in the sense you're thinking, but the the physical geologic domain evolves, right? And we're, you know, as we go into the subsequent ages of light and life, remember when you get to the fifth, as we'll read about in a little bit, you know, the master physical controllers start to really take over, and evolution geologically takes on a whole new meaning when, you know, fingers are very intimately involved in that geology. Okay, so all these issues, no magic. It's an evolutionary process. It takes a very, very long time, even with all the help you could ever imagine, to completely eradicate disease. And it's different on every world, right? The biology on every world's different. You know, they've got to reinvent the wheel on every world. So, you know, it's not like it takes less and less time the more worlds, you know, go to light and life. In many ways, they start from scratch on every world. You know, and you've got to work through the whole process of, well, what happens when you do this? Oh, that's not good. Well, how about this? You know, just a whole experiential process that every world has to go through to get to light and life and to penetrate deeper into light and life. So all those issues, you know, are trying to help us with being more realistic about our efforts now. You know, we need to be more accepting of that life expectancy and longevity are not equal. Right? That you can, and there's always a probability of you dying of something, a tree falling on you or whatnot. Right? The hurricane, you know, just went through Florida. Guy died because a tree fell on him, right? You live till you die unless a tree falls on you. Literally happened to him.
The guy who put up the horse at the Mile High at the airport.
Yeah.
That fell on, the guy who designed it, put him up, fell on him and killed him.
That doesn't change, you know, even way.
But even more on that, you know, remember when Jesus cured Lazarus, and they say that he went on, he eventually died of the same disease that he got cured of.
Right, because he did, the order wasn't to put him back differently. Put him back as he was, which means he's going to die of the same thing.
It took a while.
right. Right. But anyway, right, so all those issues, you know, we need to be more accepting. It's just, you got to die of something. It's just the way it is. I mean, you know, remember, the solution to this is not to try to somehow make your matter magical to satiate your spiritual desires. Right? Stop looking to your mortal self for eternity. That's our problem. Look to your potentially immortal self for eternity. You know, put your hopes and dreams of eternity there in that Marantia self, not in this mortal self and all of our desires to have incredibly wonderful, magical, scientific things to make that mortal self live longer and whatnot.
But they do say it's important to stay healthy.
Of course.
Because it keeps you,
of course. Again, because it's not a dichotomy.
You're housing God.
But again, see, that's the whole point. You know, we're trying to get at the truth to, you know, you know, it's not that you're not going to work on improving science. The important thing is to do it with a practical sense. Now, it's material pragmatism that should be motivating you to improve your health and, you know, and the science and whatnot, not spiritual idealism. Spiritual idealism is for spirit substance, not matter. Right? Get that separated. We have, you know, so many things that we do materially are a problem, not so much because of what they are innately, but what's motivating us, right? We have a false notion motivating our material efforts. Like if you think human equality is the right result of social injustice, no, that's false. It's not that you shouldn't deal with issues of social injustice. But, you know, you got to know that no matter how much you deal with it, it's not going to change human inequality. Because human inequality is a result of genetics. No amount of rearranging monetary molecules and stuff, right, redistribution of wealth is going to change genetics. Okay? And so that's the problem. You know, all kinds of things like that. We are driven, or we take a good thing to do to an extreme where it becomes bad because we're driven by a false motive, if you will. You know, a false desire. You know, to be more precise about it. You know, that's the problem. Not the material thing inherently itself. You know, there's a potential goodness there, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. And that's what we're doing in spades, because we're trying to cram spirit into matter and make matter do spirit things. That means matter will be the means to badness, not goodness then. That's our problem. That's why this book is in my lap. You know, it's not because we aren't spiritual enough. It's because we aren't discriminating enough to separate matter and spirit, just like the apostles. Right? Couldn't separate matter and spirit. Same problem 2,000 years later. Only now, it's led to a planetary emergency to put a book in my lap, you know, motivated by actions in a super universe. Right? That's the problem. Okay, now back to the stuff here. All right, so... You know, and you notice how just how they try to get you to think about the comparison. You know, it's certainly going to be like paradise in comparison to pre-planetary Prince Age. So they know you can get some reasonable sense, you know, of that and get a contrast. Even though, like I said, we can't really imagine what these worlds are like. Is there something on the webinar?
Yeah, David Jones is asking, in an era of light and life, in terms of terrible disease that can still manifest, mm-hmm. have you discovered anything in the book that sanctions euthanasia as a way out?
Well, you know, again...
What was the question?
You know, any sort of despair and just saying, okay, I give up with this life, let's move on to the next one. You remember the other thing that's going on with this, the philosophic advancement that's going on at the same time. There's this psychological advancement. Right, you have such a bigger worldview, and you know it's to get to despair like that, where you just want someone to end it for you. You know, more and more you've got a people that are yearning for the opportunity to have a hardship that they can demonstrate an endurance in the face of. Right? Yeah, you probably are thinking of, right, back at the beginning of Avona, right, that feast on, right?
Feast on uncertainty.
Right.
Unless you've lost your mind and lost everything.
Oh, sure. Right, sure, right. But again, remember, it's, you know, the crude things and the crude minds that we think about these issues and don't exist anymore in this state. You know, remember how, as you move with the mansion worlds, those things are gotten taken care of on the first two mansion worlds, all the stuff that we can imagine right now. You know, so we're talking about stuff that's beyond anything that we currently are thinking about with these issues, you know, mental issues and physical issues. You know, this is fifth mansion world and beyond sort of stuff we're talking about here. Okay, so none of us can even imagine the frame of mind that humans have like this. They just don't think like us at all. I mean, there isn't even remotely fear. Right, and you have this vast, solid sense of the integrity of the cosmos, and how important it is, you know, for you to face the challenge that is life outside of Avona. That the whole point is adversity. That's the whole point. You know, you're not seeking that false salvation of salvation from suffering.
Yeah, relief from suffering.
Right. It's not even remotely in your mind. You know, you're yearning for the opportunity to demonstrate your character relative. You know, there's an intense competition on these worlds to see who has the most definitive character, who can endure who can demonstrate peace that passes even that understanding, you know, at that time, let alone the understanding we have right now, right? So.
Well, I was educated in the ranches.
All right, so just, you know, and the truth of that is just, you know, now, recognize that as much as you can now, recognize that that's the challenge. Don't fall into that false worldview that that suffering is something that you have a right to try to avoid, because it's only here because of rebellion and default, or if you have an old worldview, the fall of man, or whatever the heck your worldview is, right? Original sin or something, right?
That's a good one.
It's like, no, that's an utterly false worldview. People have that worldview because they've crammed spirit into matter. They've crammed Havona into the super universe level. Right? That's not the world we live in. We live in a domain where the whole point is the challenge. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution.
He's kind of extending it to the question of senility, but
right.
I kind of think the context doesn't really change there.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's just you know, how it is that you know, the senility and stuff is dealt with, I don't know. But you know it's not going to be dealt with this. Well, let's just go around. No, God will not be mocked. You can't get around it. Right? If you don't face it here, they're going to set up those barriers on the mansion worlds. Right? That's the whole point. You know, you're not going to get away from facing the challenge and overcoming it. Right? Rather than just succumbing to it. All right. Okay, so now we've got this little block that is something that they would have had to get permission to give us. And it's maybe the same permission that gives us this that allowed them to give us government on a neighboring planet. Okay, they're giving us some specific information about another world, which is not normally done. You know, and as you read this, you know, it should remind you of kind of some of the specific stuff up in, or there in the government on a neighboring planet paper. So you've got this special allowance that's been made for the sake of this revelation to give us little tidbits like this. Now, in this case, it's not a whole paper. It's just this little block here. You can see how there's large paragraph breaks that separate this little block about some details on another world. Okay. Anything else on the webinar? Okay. All right. Let's look at read that, you know, first little header paragraph and then the 4 points.
Human government in the conduct of material affairs continues to function throughout this age of relative progress and perfection. The public activities of a world in the first stage of light and life, which I recently visited, were financed by the tithing technique. Every adult worker and all able-bodied citizens worked at something, paid 10% of his income or increase to the public treasury, and it was dispersed as follows. 1. 3% was expended in the promotion of truth, science, education, and philosophy. 3% was devoted to beauty, play, social leisure, and art. 3% was dedicated to goodness, social service, altruism, and religion. 4.1% was assigned to the insurance reserves against the risk of incapacity for labor resultant from accident, disease, old age, or unpreventable disasters.
Okay. So before we get into this little tidbit from this other world, one other little thing that they throw in to challenge you about sort of a false idealism about what light and life is going to be like. Human government in the conduct of material affairs continues to function throughout this age of relative progress and perfection. Okay? So you're not going to transcend government. You know, you've got a lot of people right now that are imagining, oh, it won't be too long in the future, we can transcend government. No. No. Need to transcend poor government, okay, but not government. You know, it's overused, but you know, baby bathwater, right? Yeah, and that's another consequence. You know, why does the baby get thrown out with the bathwater? Because again, you're blurring matter and spirit together, right? And you have this unity sense about it. You know, it requires an individuality consciousness to distinguish baby from bathwater. You know, if all you have is your unity consciousness, which blurs everything together, and tons of zeal, you know, behind it,
out it goes,
the whole thing, right? See, now, it's because you're focusing things that should be related to spirit onto matter when you're doing that. And all right, so you know, you have to distinguish between true and false government, and work on getting out of that false government mode and getting to truer and truer government. And something that even in the seventh stage of light and life, you're going to have. Right? So even then, you're not going to have humans that are going to be so incredibly complete internally that you don't need some sort of a government to help coordinate the collective phenomenon. Right? We aren't self-coordinating yet, and even deep in light and life. And you notice I purposely use that coordinating word, like we've been trying to remember that's the fundamental thing that's going on here. We've got all the parts, you know, parts are got coordinated into a whole with the work of the Trinity Teacher Sons, and so you very much, you know, when you have government, it's going to be all the more what it should be, that coordinating influence. Now, it won't be false because it's too part-like. Yeah, which is kind of just one of the things that makes, you know, it's a basic thing that makes things false right now, is that they're too part-like.
I mean, that's all aspects of the universe have government? I mean, all from on high and all the way down?
Right, you get to Havona, though, right?
One form of another.
Right, but you get to Havona, you know, okay, things are different, right? But here, you know, when you're out here in the evolutionary domains,
there's still, what is it, a union?
There's an economy to Havona, right. But it's you know, it's different than, you know, what we think of in terms of government.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, in terms of the spirit of it,
because that's just an inherently coordinate domain.
It's a pattern, right? That's just down, coming down to us.
Right, but see, that's the whole thing. You take what is inherently coordinate and you downstep it to the superuniverse level, and it's coordinating, which means it needs an over-control that fosters coordination.
And then you bring it down into the local.
Right, and just more and more, the more you bring it down, the more it has to be coordinated. But now we're talking about moving up. So yeah, it needs less and less coordination as you move it up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, never does the superuniverse level magically become like the central universe, right? Yeah. So there's always this ongoing need for coordination. This is going to be at a higher and higher and higher level, dealing with more and more subtle coordinations. All of the rudimentary things, you know, happen pretty naturally. The stuff that we currently think of with government, yeah, okay, that stuff is pretty inherent in the individuals, the integrity of the individuals. But the stuff we can't imagine still needs to be coordinated, okay, in ways that we can't imagine coordinating. Okay, all right, so there's that. Okay, and then, so the public activities of a world in the first stage of light and life that we get a little example of here. Okay, remember that if you're going to get anywhere in the developmental progress of a world, it's everyone that possibly can work is working. You know, zero idleness. You know, it's work is you know, it's compulsory.
Well, even better than that.
Yeah.
Work is desired.
Right. But it starts out being compulsory, and more becomes desired as the humans mature. Right. See, and that's just that coordination thing. See, you know, it takes on higher and subtler things. You know, it doesn't have to, you know, poke people with cattle prods, you know, anymore. Yes.
Never.
Yeah. But you notice that they, you know, they threw in that parenthetical, and all able-bodied citizens work at something. And so that reminds you, if you want to be moving towards light and life, you can't have these false notions that we currently have that it's okay for people to not be working, and that you should just support them. Now, are idealistic people, are they moving towards light and life where everyone's working? No. Their worldview is taking us in the opposite direction, to fewer and fewer people working. So they desire to get to light and life, but they're going in the opposite direction.
That's also brought up when they talk about, you know, the problem with Christianity in terms of it tolerates things like getting paid for no work, so to speak.
Right. Right.
Right here, they also talk about, which is interesting. They notice the difference between ordinary income and capital.
Right. Well, we'll get to these things here just a second before we get to the economics of it here. Okay. Yeah. So there's that working thing, and then now you notice that that the first thing that catches your eye is tithing. Before we get to the specifics, you know, it's just kind of begs a curious question. You know, we have this long-standing fascination with the concept of tithing, like it was somehow divine. You know, and so you have to note that. It's like, so you get a world of light and life, and would you look at that? It's almost like, and we have this notion, and you think it's all just fairy tale about something magical about 1,000 years. And then the religious say, well, actually, there is something to that. Right? That day, that Havona day, is basically 1,000 of your years. And right. So, you know, this reminds you that we've probably been tweaked by early revelators long ago in this direction. You know, when religionists were wondering, you know, how much should we expect of the members of our congregation, you know, maybe someone suggested, well, how about 10%? You know, because it just seems like it can't be a coincidence. You know, that they didn't have to coin a word, or they didn't just, you know, they didn't have to just say factually 10%. They could say tithing, right? Okay, so just note that. See, that's an interesting thing where, you know, you got this sort of chicken and egg mystery did we just coincidentally come up with that sort of superconsciously ourselves, or were we tweaked at some point in that direction?
Happened to be 10%. Some of the others aren't.
Well, of course, yeah. Obviously, you can rationalize anything, right? Or rationalize away anything, right? But you know, I'm not saying it's a given. I'm just noting that. Make sure you note that that's a little curiosity that you can wonder about and speculate endlessly about exactly why 10%. Now, if it is the case that is something that, let's say all worlds in light life end up with that formula, you know, you go, well, why is that? You know, there's something about the base 10 thing that must be really transcendent. Now, this is why I'm stressing this. Remember, one of the things that's happening is you're pushing towards light and life. You're more and more, you're bringing matter and spirit together into a harmony. And you have the fundamental sevenfoldness with spirit and the fundamental tenfoldness with matter. You're bringing those together. So it wouldn't be surprising, you know, if there's something literally structural in the nature of individuality, that when you get to this level where you have this incredibly objective sense of how to construct a human regulatory system, that there is only one option, that it be 10%. Right now, it seems rather arbitrary that a religionist demands a tithe. You know, why not 11%? Why not 9? Why 10? Because God said. You know, but see, it can't be anything arbitrary to it. You know, to a world that's like this, they're not doing anything arbitrary. They have all kinds of incredible in-depth thinking and reflection about everything they do, setting up this very precise system, right? You know,
is this part of the work of teacher sons as well?
Right, the teacher sons, right, see, are helping with that coordinating of bringing these different aspects of reality together into a harmonized system. See, so I'm just trying to get you to think about the bigger picture like this. There's deep mysteries that we can't even remotely penetrate right now that would be going on with this stuff. Okay. All right. Maybe just one other little thing. You know, it's just like when we talked about all of the different orders of beings and stuff. You know, there's nothing arbitrary about, you know, there's this many flavors of this kind, you know, anything. All of it is, it can only be that many flavors. You know, everything in the universe is, you know, has no wiggle room in it, right? Like we've talked about, there's an economy of Havona, right? I mean, everything is, it can be this and nothing else. You have to do it exactly that way. You know, well, what if I don't want to do it that way? Well, you will want to do it that way because you'll know that that is the only and perfect way to do it. Period. Right? Okay, something on the webinar?
Yeah, so David Jones, he's acknowledging the 10% that's paid to the government and how that's distributed, but he wants to know, do you think the church in any of its manifestations would be present at this time?
When that one religion that we're talking about knows that it has nothing to do with material or even really social affairs, right? Those religionists don't even get any sort of honors on earth. No matter how transcendent a job, how great a job they do, because they know they're doing a spiritual job. They're doing things with that other substance.
They may worship together.
There's all these things, right? There's all those sorts of religious things, but remember to focus in on how, you know, they have a, when you're talking about one religion, you're talking about a religion of the spirit, a religion that doesn't have anything to do with matter. It doesn't have anything to do with your mind. It has to do with that other substance in the external world. Right, you have an objective religion, which means it's out of the subjective domain of your mind. It's tied to the objective domain, the external world, and that other substance. Right? There's no way to get one religion if it's still a religion of the mind. You know, remember, there's no one on this planet has a religion of the spirit. No one. Everyone has a religion of the mind. You know, it's just they call fancy mind spirit. No religionist is thinking there's another substance in the external world that you can build buildings out of and stub your toe on, you know, and that, you know, their religion is tied to the laws of that other substance, just like science is tied to the laws of the material substance in the external world. No one's thinking about religion like that. Everyone thinks it's, you know, you go inside and it's, there's a certain feelings, you know, inside, and that's religion.
You said stub your toe. You were speaking figuratively.
It's spiritual.
Right, there'll be a day when you can stub your toe on a spirit brick, right?
And you'll be wiser.
right, but Yeah, when you leave the world, local universe is the first stage spirit, right? Right. Spirit isn't something that you may think, oh, I got to go deep inside somewhere. No, I need to use my hands and pick up this brick, move it over there. That just remember how different religion is when you actually approach it objectively from the top down from anything that any religionist is imagining right now. Right? To get to that one religion, to get to true religion, you have to transcend yourself, right? Your mindful self. You got to get above that mindful self.
Has anybody ever
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, no one is doing that consciously. I mean, we have a little bit by grace, super consciously, unconsciously, but not consciously. But I can encourage you right now, when you see that religion of the spirit, don't think, ooh, yeah, that fancy mind stuff that I feel. No. Spirit is another substance in the external world. Try to figure out what the heck that means. What is a religion of the spirit? Anyway, back to this. Okay, so now John was wanting to get out. Okay, so you notice they say 10% of his income or increase. Okay. Now this brings in an important point about right now. Because we're trying to make matter be spirit, back in the beginning of the 20th century, we started to get very zealous about this. And we started to get way ahead of ourselves. We had to actually modify the Constitution. We were so ahead of ourselves in order to allow for the income tax. Right? We had to violate the truth, the integrity of that Constitution in order to satisfy our desires, we didn't recognize it, for the age of light and life, when it's appropriate to have an income tax. Why is it inappropriate now? Because in the light and life, you've way transcended the profit motive. Right? Remember what they tell you. About the profit motive, right? By no means should you let your desire for light and life jump ahead, and short circuit the profit motive, because for a long, long time, it is very indispensable to any sort of progressing civilization, right? It's the only way to incentivize a human. If you take it away, you de-incentivize work. What did they point out about work? Do they have huge percentages of people not working like we do right now? And we pretend we don't by not counting them? The games we play with ourselves? Oh, we have this really low unemployment. Because we pretend these other people don't exist and we don't count them as unemployed. Not working. Right? Right? We play all these games because we want matter to be spirit. Everyone has to be working. And the only way for a long, long time for everyone to be working is with profit motive. Yes, as you go along, more and more people can transfer over to service motive. But only after a long, long, long time. Right? Only when you get to here do you see that it's appropriate to do what would have de-incentivized work for a long time, an income tax. Right. That is very, very inappropriate right now. We are way ahead of ourselves. We're de-incentivizing work. Work is important to self is not. Right? The most important thing is for everyone to be working right now and with whatever motivation they can muster. And most people can't think abstractly enough to be motivated by service. Right? Profit, the tangibility of profit is the only thing that can motivate them. Right? That's an important element of this.
I'm not quite sure what you said there. Are you challenging income tax, or are you
I'm just pointing out, notice we had to change the Constitution to make it legal. And there's a reason for that, because the founders knew it was wrong.
Well, maybe, but then most, you know, money doesn't just disappear. Mm-hmm. The income tax goes into giving people jobs so that people can work.
Yeah, I know. But see, it's just...
And so it's sort of like a vicious...
Yeah, but see, it's a whole... It's not the indirect thing, the argument, that's the bottom line. It's important to recognize that you have to have this very simple thing where people are not going to be motivated by some trickle-down roundabout acquirement of the benefits of their labor. They want it directly or it doesn't exist. They're not motivated.
No, you're right. People on welfare are not motivated.
Right. We have to recognize this. We've got our, because for the last 2,000 years, and it actually took until the beginning of the 20th century for us to get spiritual enough, and yet not separating matter and spirit, trying to make matter do more and more, right? We have all these ideas of rearranging molecules and getting to light and life. I mean, that's the, it's the progressive income tax, remember? Because it's progressivism, right? I mean, it's not that humans shouldn't pay tax, right? But see, it's just the whole point is, I have a tax bill that I get, and then I pay that tax, not, well, this is actually the government's money, and they're going to take their part, and then they'll give you the crumbs that are left. See, notice how that's just totally turned around. Right? That's the problem. I don't want to go off forever on this, because this is kind of gets into all the details of the science of government. But, that's one of the reasons why things like the government on a neighboring planet and this are here. For the science of government, and they're trying to get you to recognize it's not that in eternity the notion of income tax is wrong. It's just we're way ahead of ourselves. Right? The relatives try to make that point a lot. When you're going through the civilization papers, that's one of the key things they try to pound in. They take some very simple thing, and they say, because of that, civilization collapsed. And you're going, what's wrong with that? And they say, well, inherently there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that they did it too soon. See, and your spiritual consciousness doesn't know too soon. It has no concept of time. It thinks, well, if it's good, I should be able to do it now.
Right now.
No. If you do something that's good then, now, it's bad. It's good or bad depending on where it fits in the evolutionary process. You've got to take that evolutionary process into account. Okay? Yep.
So being an experimental planet, the experiment was, one of them was, bringing will to creatures early.
Right.
Came real early. Right. And it may be that part, and that's sort of something that's intangible in a way. I mean, maybe these kinds of things that you're talking about that we are experiencing or realizing we are also repercussions of the experimental aspect in some way. As you said, if we're doing something that we should be doing in the light and life, maybe today, it's maybe not wrong for them, but maybe not right for now.
Right.
Maybe part of that whole, off-kilter bit of experiment.
Yeah, but remember, fundamentally, we would have had guides. The prince's staff and Adam and Eve and whatnot would have been teaching us the science of government. In the whole grand scheme of the evolution of the finite, we're mapping out part of the supreme that can only get mapped out with those that aren't told these truths up front and have to discover them through the school of hard knocks. Right? But just, if you're wondering why it is that things are getting more and more difficult in our civilization, it's not because we don't have very high, positive, idealistic desires. It's because we are thinking too existentially. We aren't recognizing the kairos of things. There's a proper time for things. You can't just apply them any old time. You have to have the wisdom and objectivity to know when the time is right. Did Jesus teach us that? Did he not teach us that?
Yeah.
My hour has not yet come, he said, right? It's a very simple thing, but it's universal. There isn't anything that you do that that is potentially good that can't be made bad by doing it too soon. Nothing. You can take any good thing and make it bad by doing it too soon. Or doing it in the wrong place. See, the wrong place or the wrong time. You have to take into account space and time.
Or too late.
Or too late or whatever, right, yeah. Right. But see, I mean, you know, it's, you know, your impatience of your spiritual consciousness doesn't tend to do things too late, see. Did Lucifer or, you know, Adam and Eve do things too late? No. They did things too soon. Right.
Yeah.
But your material indolence too late.
Right, yeah.
We've got plenty of that too.
Yeah, but see, the whole thing is we're starting to overcome a lot of our late, you know, inherent blob of protoplasm, you know, inertia. Since the spiritual uplift, we can juice ourselves up quite a bit now. We can get the blob of protoplasm off its derriere with a lot more gusto than we could 4,000 years ago. Okay? And especially in the last 50 years, right? Now that you've got a real juicing of the sixth adjutant, we're all the more zealous about things. We're very animated, right? You know, I mean, you know, 1,000 years ago, there weren't people going around, what do we want, fill in the blank, when do we want it now? There weren't people marching around with those signs. Okay? They're doing it now, not even 100 years ago, right?
Yeah.
All right. This, okay, we are in the full-blown mode of impatience, and we're going to do everything too soon.
Now.
Not that it's existentially wrong. Most likely it's existentially right. That's why you want to do it with your spiritual consciousness. But you're going to do it too soon, and you're going to collapse civilization. And that's why this book is in my lap. Not to tell me, you know, what is existentially good and bad.
But who's going to listen to say and slow down.
Yeah, right. What fun is that? What fun is patience?
Right.
Well, you should be able to point out obvious misuse of language, like the earned income tax credit. The money you're giving to people that they...
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. Like I said, we don't need to go off into the science and all the falsehood that we have in the science of government right now. Right. But I'm just trying to, you know, there's all kinds of things they could have told you about this world enlightened life. Notice the couple little things that they told you about. Oh my goodness! All it was, you know, if someone said, "I want to tell you something about a world enlightened life," you're going, and your first thought is, "Please tell me about what they do with their income tax." Is that the first thought you had in your head? What you were really interested in?
No.
No, no. See, that's one of the very few things that they're telling us about a world enlightened life. There must be something very, very important there. A truth there that is, that our lack of recognition of it is on the verge of collapsing civilization right now. Right? And they're trying giving it in this context so you recognize why you have this desire. Because you desire. You can even begin to visualize towards light and life for the last 2,000 years. Right? You know, it's Michael's fault that we have this ability to visualize very far in the future now.
Right?
But we have no pragmatism to know how to arrange things and when to do things and how, you know.
Is fault the right word? Maybe it's his purpose.
No, no, tongue-in-cheek, quote-unquote fault, right? I mean, right. And we've talked about that many times, you know, the whole universe, are you sure you want to give these unbiologically upstep creatures more spiritual consciousness? Are you sure?
He's going to do what?
That doesn't look wise to me. Yeah, and he said, what do you mean, doesn't look wise? How do you get wisdom? Through tribulation, right? I'm going to give them some automatic tribulation, because boy, are they going to do things ahead of the appropriate time, and they're going to experience nothing but tribulation, and boy, are they going to have opportunity for wisdom. Right? So,
if they think you're going to attack me and take away my heart.
And the revelators are saying, yeah, that's, you know, don't expect, you know, this revelation isn't here to get us away from tribulation, but But there's tribulation and then there's tribulation, right? Remember, like they say, you need evil, but you don't need sin and iniquity, right? Right? You need tribulation, but you don't need global catastrophe, right? Right. This book is here not to, you know, to speak directly to the issue of tribulation and how problematic it is. Right? It's to speak to the fact that there's a potential collapse of civilization.
Off your lap and out into the
world. Right. So you got to do something with this, and that means you got to reflect on this stuff. Right.
Change yourself.
It's not just about, you know, your inner life and how to make it feel warmer. Right, it's all kinds of stuff about outer life, like 3% to this, all these outer life issues with precision. Okay, anyway, let's continue on here. So notice the fun little thing that they do here. Your relationship to the existential is being acknowledged, truth, beauty, goodness. Okay? So they're trying to leverage off of that. Say, Now, think a little less in terms of it's all about you and your feelings about those things, and those three words, and you know, think about bringing them out into the outer life. You know, what if you downstep that existential triplet, you know, to your outer life, so that truth goes out as science, education, and philosophy, and beauty goes out as play, social, leisure, and art. And goodness goes out as social service, altruism, and religion.
Okay.
So that you can possibly not be so heavenly minded you're no earthly good. Okay. Now, and again, the other thing to note that they, even in this list, they put them in truth, beauty, goodness order, rather than beauty, truth, goodness order. Right? Because what did I say? Like to get to one religion? Right, you've got to get top down. Philosophy, true philosophy, and then in the context, the wholeness of true philosophy, a true religion. Right, so you start top down, truth, and then down to beauty and goodness. Right, like we always point out. So notice that. And you see this balance between the threefold actuality, 3%, 3%, 3%. Okay. As opposed to, well, my unity consciousness, I think number three should be 8%, and right, or your material, your bias to your material consciousness, I think number one should be 9%, and actually we had lots of science, and you know, no, it's balanced. Matter, mind, and spirit, individuality, associativity, unity, you know, to bring them together, you have to balance them and then harmonize them. Balance and proportion comes from which of your adjutants? Which is the energy of symmetry? Seventh adjutant, right? You got to bring that seventh adjutant into play, or there's no hope of thinking in a balanced way like this about these three. You got to go above your religious impulse. You've got to get into that philosophic impulse, the seventh adjutant. All right, and then you notice this reminds you a bit of some of the government on the neighboring planet things, like, you know, with the insurance set up like they talk about there. And remember there, too, remember how they talk about how many on that island continent have moved beyond profit motive, right? And so, you know, you got to think about the things that they say there in that light, right? We haven't even remotely gotten to the point where we're moving beyond the profit motive, right? So you can't just apply those things up there, let alone the things here, because that's way not the appropriate time. You're getting way ahead of yourself. You know, if you try to apply the setup for a world that's moving beyond the profit motive, or a nation that's moving beyond the profit motive, you know, to our circumstances right now, especially, you know, you go beyond the United States, right? You know, even more so. I mean,
let's put things in perspective. That 1% in mm-hmm. the labor, accidents, disease, old age, unpreventable disasters, all those things.
Yeah, 1%.
1%. In my industry,
yeah.
Yeah.
in round numbers, about 10% is of what I pay for labor goes to workers' comp, just for labor related injuries.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with what's going on.
All the other stuff,
all the other things that people are faced.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so, right, that reminds you, as you're recognizing, oh, we must be kind of in light in life, or all of those, most of those rudimentary things that we're insuring against now are long in the rearview mirror. But, like they said above, there are still all those issues in play to a small degree, so it does take 1% to cover it. Okay? But you notice how it's all in the context of against the risk of incapacity for labor. Right? Not to support people who don't want to work. In these worlds, I don't want to work. Oh, well, isn't that special? You know, is what they say to you. You're working anyway.
You get to retire.
So it's rehab?
At some point, there's probably some backing off of, but, the other thing about working there, remember for us, work is, we think physical, because we're so limited yet. Right, there's all kinds of intellectual labor that's going on. I mean, the great rewards are for transcendent intellectual discoveries and labor on those worlds. And so you can labor intellectually way beyond where you could labor in the fields.
Not physical.
Yeah.
Plus, they're only working an hour a day.
Right. And there's all those things too. Right. Yeah. Right.
So that's just for their material thing and. The rest of their motivation is, toward higher pursuits.
Right, but there, all those other things are still laboring, even if they are quote unquote, work to handle the,
voluntary at that point.
Right, and see all that stuff. I mean, don't forget, all these things are in the context of a world enlightened life. Yeah. So there's all of this self-motivating, nature to the people. They voluntarily. Squeeze every bit of profit for the greater good out of their playtime, right? And they're constantly thinking of ways that they can rearrange their play life so that it redounds to the greater good more. And I mean, it's the social service and altruism, right? That's just kind of inherent. Is amazing. Would be amazing to us. Like I said, we would just be agog, watching these people, how altruistic, for instance, they would be,
I don't think we should look at the fact that we haven't made forays into some of these things, or that they're so completely foreign that it's almost a black and white proposition. You had things like the Chautauqua movement at the turn of the last century, where people were deciding to use their leisure. Whether they were getting much out of it depended on the individual, but there were a lot of higher pursuits, intellectual and artistic pursuits that people were willingly taking vacation to go listen to people lecture.
Yeah, definitely. It's important to notice when that started happening, especially you get to the middle of the 19th century, and then moving into the 20th, right? It's pretty obvious that there is an awakening an awareness beyond the end of your nose in mankind that's quite admirable. However, you can also notice how our farsightedness is diminishing, and more people can't get past the end of their nose now again.
Doesn't it feel polarizing to you?
Yeah.
Past the cell phone screen.
Right. I mean, everyone walks around staring at their hand. Right? And literally dying because they're so self-absorbed that they walk into traffic. I mean, that's a far cry from, the Chautauqua movement.
It is.
Okay, and we need to notice that. Okay? And remember, like they tell you in the adjuster papers, you get 50% of the youth that are materially self-absorbed like that, and things are going to get really dicey. You're not going to be making any progress. And you get 75% and you're done. It implodes. That's the end. All right, so Right, that's the emergency. That's why the book is in my lap, for us to recognize that. You can't pretend that we are still manifesting our recognition of ideals as well as we used to. It's starting to slip. Started to get grim in the 80s, and it's gotten grimmer ever since. Okay. All right. All right, then one little tiny single sentence paragraph.
The natural resources of this planet were administered as social possessions, community property.
Okay. And again, you go, why on earth this one little tidbit? Why didn't they stick that up in the preface or to the four items or something? Why do they set that one little item all apart? Now, anyone who's remembers the government on a neighboring planet, go, oh, wait a minute, I recognize that. Yeah, that's the same thing as they have on the island continent, that idealistic island continent. Right, again, and why? If you don't understand why that is, you're going to try to manifest that too soon. Why can that neighboring planet, island continent, not the rest of the neighboring planet, but that island continent, and why can this world have the natural resources of the planet administered as social possessions, community property? Again, same reason as before. You don't need the profit motive. Right? You've transcended the fundamental indispensable. Remember, it's not just helpful. It's indispensable, the profit motive. The only way to go forward is with the profit motive. Once you have the majority phenomenon not needing the profit motive, you can start having more things in community possession like that. But notice how our spiritual consciousness has gone racing forward, and we can imagine everything being community possession, right? And we're into communism. And what does the Revelator say? Okay, well, that's dandy, guys, because there isn't anything more primitive than that. Right? You can't think of a more primitive. That's pre-family consciousness, communism. Right? You're in pure horde mode, where you don't even have family units, when you're thinking that falsely idealistic. Right? Yep.
Well, there's another place, I don't remember where, but it mentions augmenting profit motive with service motive.
Right, it's in the profit motive section.
Not replacing,
right.
Augmenting.
Yeah. It's in the profit motive section. Everyone can take a point of going reading the profit motive section in the civilization papers and reminding, if you want to be reminded, it's just a little section about some of those details. Yes, it's an evolutionary thing. You start where you have nothing but profit motive, and the leading edge of the bell curve of the people of that society start transitioning into service motive. And, it's going to take all kinds of wisdom to rearrange, the structure of that society to keep everything in balance, between those driven by service motive and those driven by profit motive. There's all kinds of complexities of the science of that, right, that have to be worked out as an evolutionary phenomenon. Right? But slowly, you just have the trailing tail of the bell curve, still needing the profit motive. And but the whole point is, it's easy to imagine light and life with what Michael did to us 2,000 years ago. We can imagine very far, way ahead of what's appropriate. And try to implement it now. I mean, the fundamental way to think about that precisely is you can recognize an ideal, but you can't apply an ideal directly. You have to downstep that ideal into an idea that takes into account the specifics of the place and time in which you exist. You can't apply a temporal, a spatial ideal right in front of your feet. Right?
Hence Gordon Gekko's famous line, greed is good.
Right. I mean, Greed is the father's way, like we've talked about many times, as a scaffolding phenomenon for a stretch of time, the material comfort era, right? The only way to get to light and life is through the material comfort era, you know, at a certain point. The only way to get to light and life is with greed, tyranny, gluttony, you know, drunkenness, etc. Right? There is no other way, right? And you say, well, we should try it. Maybe there is another way. Lucifer did. That was his whole point. He said, let's skip the material comfort era and all those other things, and let's go right to light and life. Right?
Well, a lot of us have tried that. And have learned.
Yeah.
You know, and people do move on.
Individuals, right? But see, that's the whole thing. We're fundamentally talking about the collective phenomenon, you know? And there always needs to be individuals during the material comfort era that are in that world but not of that world. You can't get to the next age if there aren't people in that time that are, you know, lights in that relative darkness, right? You know, it's not like, you know, I'm saying everyone should debase themselves, right? No, it might be your role to be a light shining in the darkness. Now, be careful. It's easy to delude yourself. You know, maybe you're one of the Alpheus twins. Okay.
Maybe.
and maybe it isn't your role to be the light shining in the darkness, but just to toil humbly as the tadpole of that age.
Not your light socially.
Right? Okay. But again, just remember, the fifth epoch of Revelation, like I've tried to stress, is here for those who want to be in their age but not of their age. That's the whole point of a non-dispensational revelation. Right? Unlike a dispensational revelation where it's for everyone, that a non-dispensational revelation is to try to establish the parallel stream, the parallel little stream relative to the main big evolutionary stream, right? The little parallel stream of people who are in the world but not of the world, who are in that age but not of that age, who are the potential seeds of progress and help for the main evolutionary stream, you know, when it needs it, if it needs it. That's the whole point. This is for those who feel like they're in a straitjacket to be just of the material comfort era. This is the good news for those people. But you got to recognize that there's a whole physics to that other stream, right? Just because you pull yourself out of that and are more relatively enlightened relative to the bulk of humanity, doesn't mean that you have a right to thrust yourself upon that because that stream is wrong and you're right. No, that stream is just as right as you are.
Well, and there's an attachment to reality. Like, you're in that life, may not be of that life, but you're still in it.
Yeah, right. You know, and remember that tendency, you pull yourself out a little bit, and the first thing you're going to have a tendency to do is to impose a change upon the bigger stream, change without growth. Right? You're going to forget about the necessity for that stream to grow to the point where you inject in your influence into it. But you don't want to, forget about that. I don't have time for that. I want to inject it now because it needs it now. But change without growth is potential evil, right? You have a desire to do good by injecting into that. But if you do it inappropriately, instead of getting good, you'll get evil. Change without growth is potential evil. And if you actually act upon it, it will be actualized evil, not potential evil. All of this, and it's like, well, where do I get the wisdom to know when?
Right, well, you make an excellent point. When do you get the wisdom to know when? When do you get the wisdom to know when not?
Not.
You know, because you have, you look at, I mean, it's like Jesus in the temple. He already knew they were likely to reject him at that point. He gave them one last chance. Even with that knowledge. Now that's an interesting injection into the stream and swimming against the current.
Yeah, the tricky thing about, you know, using examples from Jesus' public ministry is, in general, they're not appropriate examples, remember, for us, because he's true God there also.
Okay.
You know, and it's appropriate for, a personalized deity to do certain things.
Was it not appropriate if he had just been a forward-looking man? Because he was man and God.
Right. I don't claim to know what is appropriate. I'm just saying, it's going to be more complicated. That's why I always suggest probably try to find an example that's useful from when he was a third circler. Mm-hmm. You know, rather than post-fusion. You know, look for an example in his ministry around the Mediterranean that you can draw upon. Because that's less likely to be fraught with, that's not totally appropriate because, you know, he's actually doing Michael stuff too and not just man stuff. It's not to say that you can't mine the public ministry, but it's just, it's fraught with potential misinterpretation because you might, not be properly separating God and man. You know, so you just got to kind of keep that in mind. That's why it's just so cool that you have, his private ministry times, where you don't have to worry about that issue. You just have, he's nothing but true man, and he's the highest example of anything you could strive for right now, a third circler, right? I mean, work on that, right? You got time for post-third circler stuff, in the future. I mean, see if you can just do something that a third circler did so splendidly, And remember, if you go, but he didn't have very big impact on the outer life when he was a third circler around the Mediterranean. Yeah, remember, you're not sovereign of the outer life. The Most Highs are sovereign in the outer life, not you.
Walk that pride.
Right? Your job is to master yourself. Right? And if you succeed to some degree in mastering yourself, you can impact locally, the outer life, like Jesus did as he ministered, as he passed by around the Mediterranean. Right? He touched people's lives very definitively. He didn't alter the economic system of the Roman Empire. Right? Revolutionize the economic system or something like that. No. Right? You go, I want to do something grand. Yeah, but that's not your job. You're not sovereign of the outer life. Now, pick something that's more your size, you. Right? The great man is it the one that takes a city or overthrows a nation? No. Right. It's he who subdues his own tongue. Right. Your job is self-mastery. The inner life. You need to master that self. That's your job. You don't have another job. Right? It's only icing on the cake if coincidentally you achieve enough self-mastery that you're of some use to the outer life and will be put to use. Right?
But first,
is to not fall into the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto and think that you're innately divine and ready to go. The outer life needs me. Right? I don't have to worry that there might be something that could be problematic if I thrust it out there. I'm innately divine. Right? I desire to do good. That's all, that makes me good. Boom, anything I do is good. Who said that? Let me think. I think there was something like Cano and Eve. Right. There's all these examples right in the book trying to teach us this. It's like people, okay? Right? You're not sovereign of the outer domain, okay? Start with first things first. If you want to be great, start with yourself, not the outer life.
That is great.
Okay. All right. So anyway, in terms of the little specifics that they give you, kind of on the scale of the government on a neighboring planet, they give you this bit about taxing income and about natural resources as community property. Right, and see, it all has to do with that. You've moved past the profit motive, and you can start to take things out of that immediate, tangible domain for an individual. you know, which is the only carrot that, you know, gets him to move his feet, right? You know, they don't, you know, you don't need those very material, tangible carrots to get people to move anymore. So you can take on these more idealistic expressions. Okay? But that's only down the road that's appropriate. Okay, what else do they give us here?
On this world, the highest honor conferred upon a citizen was the order of supreme service, being the only degree of recognition ever to be granted in the Maurantia temple. This recognition was bestowed upon those who had long distinguished themselves in some phase of supermaterial discovery or planetary social service.
And see, so the one, like you can see, I was thinking about that when I was speaking a little bit ago. See, supermaterial discovery, intellectual discovery, spiritual discovery. So, that, like we talked about as they were beginning this paper, remember, everyone in this age is striving to be a master of philosophy. Right, so when we're talking about supermaterial discovery, it's in that mode. You know, it's some expression of mastery, you know, relative to recognition of the big picture, putting the big picture together, and then using that recognition of the big picture to the benefit of the whole planet. See, planetary social service. Not community social service, planetary social service. See, so it has, you know, you've discovered some very universalizable, significant thing, and you were either the discoverer or fundamental in the implementation of it in a global expression.
The term supreme service could be service to
the
supreme.
Exactly right. Because that was the thing I was just going to point out. You know, when these people are saying supreme service, that's not like some petty dictator calling themselves the supreme leader. Right, no, they mean supreme. They mean transfinite. Right, that this person has taken a hold of the whole of the finite, discovered the wholeness, and found a way to bring that wholeness down to earth. Okay, right. Supreme service, not just really cool finite service. Okay. Yeah. Okay, and then one other little tidbit.
The majority of social and administrative posts were held jointly by men and women. Most of the teaching was also done jointly. Likewise, all judicial trusts were discharged by similar associated couples.
Two different things that they give you here. The first ones we read are talking about we could easily get ahead of ourselves. These two about supreme service, and then this, you know, this whole bit of how do we get a social structure that has equity, right? You know, in the differential between men and women. You know, what thing could we start to work on now or work towards now, and we wouldn't get ahead of ourselves. Like these other things, we can easily get ahead of ourselves. Here are some. I mean, just notice these few little things that they give you, what they give you. You know, you go, yeah, and we've never really thought about that. You know, to really honor and foster a more complete expression of maleness and femaleness, rather than, you know, trying to somehow blur them together, but, you know, recognize the importance of that difference, foster the full expression of that difference, and then bring it together, work on it being intimately, you know, juxtaposed and starting to coordinate together, right? To leverage off of that. I mean, see, these men and women recognize, you know, the man recognizes what the woman is bringing to it that he can't bring, and the woman is recognizing what the man brings to it that she can't bring. And that's why they're working joyfully together. You know, and it's sanctioned by the whole society, because the whole society recognizes this truth. Right? If you can get the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two, that'll push us forward, right? One of the reasons why you can't move towards light and life, because the only way to get there is off of the super additive consequences, the differential between men and women. And so again, think about how we are, oops, we're turned 180 degrees, aren't we? And we're getting more and more so. More and more our idealistic people, our spiritually conscious people are thinking, we need to, you know, ignore or deny or, you know, try to regulate against the differential between men and women, pretend like they're interchangeable parts, you know, et cetera. No, no, that's 180 degrees. That's not going to take you towards light and life. That's pushing you backwards. Until you have definitive differential, you can't get the super additive consequence. And you can't go forward. See, this is what they're trying to teach us. Just notice how messed up we are. We're getting more and more so. We're literally trying to convince ourselves that there isn't a difference between men and women. And there's none so blind as those who will not see. We're bringing will into this and willfully blinding ourselves to this difference. Forcing ourselves to pretend that it's not there, function as if it's not there. Punishing ourselves if we hint that there might be a difference, right? Right? You're socially ostracized if you suggest there might be a difference between a man and a woman. Right? It's so absurd. Right? And not only is it absurd,
it's a fine line.
It's like, do you want to get into light and life or not? Just boil it down to that. Just tell yourself, do I want to get to light and life or not? If I do, the relatives are telling you the physics of how you get there. You don't get there the way you think you get there now. It appears to us that what we're doing will get us to light and life. But appearance is not reality. It isn't really how it gets you to light and life. All these things that we're doing that appear to be what would get us to light and life, to a better world, coincidentally are the opposite. That's how much difference there is between appearance and reality to an ignorant mind like ours.
Decoys.
Right? We don't see things truthfully. We see things, but we don't see them truthfully. And so there's a big difference between appearance and reality. 180 degrees almost all the time. Right? I bring this up all the time. No matter where you are in the book, you know, you read something like, we think the opposite of that. Yeah, over and over and over again. It's not like we're like 2 degrees off. It's always 180 degrees. We're just exactly opposite. Right? Because it's because we're immersed in a stream. Right? There's a directionality to reality. And so, you know, if you move off the line, you're either parallel or anti-parallel. Right? There's an instability to be just a little off. It literally, it's a binary system.
It flips.
But wouldn't you think the inertia of the system moving forward would straighten you out?
Yes, it would. But inertia can be overruled by will, the exercise of will.
Well, that's stupid.
Why did God give us free will? See, that's the whole thing. See, the more you're given and the more you use what you're given, the more responsibility you have, right? When everyone is just a fancy animal, right, things we progress in spite of ourselves, right? Because, you know, we get a little offline and there's just this whole vast conspiracy that tends to get us back online again and we plow forward. But the more we can bring in our will and say, you know, you're not the boss of me, right? Right, that's what we're doing. That's why there's an emergency.
Well, it just redefines herding cats.
Right, because we are willing ourselves, you know, to not just go with the flow of reality, mm-hmm. and say, well, let's just stop doing that. It's like, no, you know, to go forward, you have to start willing things, which means you have to have the wisdom, objectivity, to know what the direction is. When you start bringing in your own directionizing, instead of just the directionizing of the whole, you know, just glacially mowing you along, right? You have to see the big picture yourself.
You have to want to
choose to orient with the cosmos, right? And more we are choosing to orient, but not with the cosmos, because, you know, why should I look to others for the truth? Am I not the truth? Right? That's self-righteousness.
Wow.
Okay. All right. All right, so there you have it. A little aside there, a little tidbit from another planet, and I'm sure needed a little bit of special permission. But you can see how it strikes you as probably fell in the context of that what they gave us from the neighboring planet, because a lot of it is kind of the same flavor. But it augments what they gave you on the neighboring planets, you know, to really think about, you know, the difference between what's appropriate for a world enlightened life and what's appropriate, you know, now for us. Right? We haven't even gotten into the quest for knowledge and wisdom yet. Right? You know, we're trying to get it. Got a little bit of quest for knowledge, but, you know, now we're losing that. We have a quest for information now. We still have a zealous quest for information, but no one really cares about knowledge anymore.
No one cares about facts.
Right? As long as you can, you know, collect some data and rationalize it, we're all happy. Right. So, anyway, I digress. I'm, you know me. If you get me on that on that soapbox. Okay, let's keep going here.
On these superb worlds, the childbearing period is not greatly prolonged. It is not best for too many years to intervene between the ages of a family of children. When close together in age, children are able to contribute much more to their mutual training. And on these worlds, they are magnificently trained by the competitive systems of keen striving in the advanced domains and divisions of diverse achievement in the mastery of truth, beauty, and goodness. Never fear but that even such glorified spheres present plenty of evil, real and potential, which is stimulative of the choosing between truth and error, good and evil, sin and righteousness.
Okay, another packed little paragraph. Okay, let's start with the first stuff first. Remember how we're thinking, well, should we kind of just think about taking a 100-year lifespan and stretching it out into 500? You know, and I said, well, you know, don't take that too literally. Here's an example, see. Don't take the childbearing years in that model and stretch it out, you know, don't multiply it by 5. Right, so women still have a relatively short span in which of childbearing years, okay, for the reasons that they're talking about there. And that should just remind you all the more about, you know, unlike men, women get this very definitive, biologically expressed experience of the transition from daughter to son, from stationary horizontal daughter to ascending son, right? You go through that change, that life change, right? So women on these worlds, you know, living 500 years, you know, will have that, the poignancy of that transition, and then in the context of their mortal life, moving forward into that, seeing themselves as an ascending being, as opposed to a temporary substitute for the creative mother spirit who can't be a material womb, but there needs to be a womb for a little while. But that's only a temporary need. You know, you grow out of that quickly. You know, so there's just notice that little tidbit about how that's playing into this.
Kind of like the butterfly coming out of the
cocoon. Yeah, right. You've got, you know, women have a much more definitive experience, especially, see, when you put it in this 500-year context of that difference between, you know, caterpillar and butterfly than a man ever will. See, so, you know, a woman contributes, you know, a recognition to this that a man will never be able to contribute to the cosmos. And here you see it starting to really play out in the mortal life. There'll be that long span of, you know, you're not of childbearing age anymore. And yet, it's not like they become men. No, you know, like they said in the previous paragraph, right? They're still women, but see, you know, that's the other thing. You know, when you live for 500 years in this advanced stage, you begin to actually get what the difference is between male and female instead of just, you know, the animal difference, the animal origin difference like we currently understand it, right? You'll start to better understand what the real differential is there. Once men and women can overcome the low-level just, you know, hormonal and crude biological differentials, right? So that this super additive thing we were talking about can really manifest. Right? It's hard for that super additive thing to happen when we're still so bogged down by our animal differential. We've got to overcome that. I can't just be, you know, a sex hunger, right? And a woman can't just be a maternal instinct, right? You know, in these worlds, right, there's hundreds of years of men and women transcending that. Men not just being an ever-present sex hunger, and women not just being a hopelessly, you know, place-like maternal instinct, you know? And they can't think past the, you know, the circle of their skirt, you know, and the children that are huddled around them. Right? Not that that isn't very important stuff. It's not that my sex impulse is an important thing to the perpetuation of the species, but it's not part of eternity. And I've got to transcend that at some point.
Darn.
There's got to be more to me than that sex impulse, as hard as that is for my animal origin nature to imagine.
It'll be all right.
Something, right, yeah. But each of us has this challenge, right? Like the relators, yeah, point out, you know, in those, again, those civilization papers and the marriage and family papers. Now, anyway, we digress again.
Okay, we're not going to get through this section tonight anyway.
Okay, so, all right, so we have, let's see, notice the competitive systems, right? A lot of idealistic people think that a big problem is competition, and we could have light in life if we could transcend competition. Again, no, you're looking backwards again. You know, you have no competition when you have the vanilla horde, when there's no individuation. Right, that's the most primitive state. You know, there's competition on high amongst all the universe beings. Right, the more personal you are, the more that absolute differential between two persons is in competition one with the other. But you're in competition to go up, right?
Well,
yeah.
When this paper started, and it was telling about one language, one religion, I think, aren't those differentials? What will we have for a differential?
Personality, right. The differential you can't transcend. Absolutely unique personality. Endless cycles of eternity won't transcend that absolute differential. Right? There's always a tension there for a super additive potential consequence. Right? Okay, and then, you know, the one that really is a zinger. Never fear, but that even such glorified spheres present plenty of evil. Were you worried about that? Right. When you imagine light and life, you imagine a world without any evil.
Clouds and cherries.
Yeah. Now, this should remind you, remember, we already talked about this, right? When we talked about especially the first two mansion worlds, right? Hey, you got to recognize, you know, you go to heaven. Okay, and you don't transcend evil. You know, first dimension, you're not going to transcend sin and iniquity. You know, some of your fellow travelers on the second mansion world are going to go to iniquity. Right? Okay, now on a world enlightened life, right, you are, remember we're like at fifth mansion world and beyond, sort of, you know, and we're getting into light and life. Okay, so you are starting to, you know, get beyond some really crude things, but there's still plenty of evil. Plenty of it. And you're going, if you were thinking objectively, you would have been concerned. It's like, well, am I going to vanilla, you know, make everything vanilla here? Am I going to lose all the important differentials? What about the inevitabilities? Right, they said that one of the things I was doing was altruism. Is altruism desirable? Then must... Right? There'd be a differential. Right? They're reminding you, no, the differential is not going to go away. You need that. You need that differential. And then notice, you know, stimulative of choosing between truth and error, good and evil, sin and righteousness. Three pairs. Do you notice something? Look at the pattern.
They go back and forth.
Right. Positive, negative, positive, negative, negative, positive. Why did they flip the last one? Why isn't it righteousness and sin so that it's in line with truth and error, good and evil? Why did they flip it?
Because it's super additive.
Yeah, you're getting at it, yeah. I mean, we're talking about, like when you look on the threefold actuality chart, right? Here's truth and error, goodness and evil, right? And of course, you also have fact and figment. Right, you go down here you get righteousness and sin, right? When you get down to the personality block, right? We're in that mode about truth, fact, truth, goodness, as opposed to beauty, truth, goodness. And we've got the bottom up of truth and goodness, and they're contrasting error and evil, right? But if I can get up above the parts and start approaching it from the top down, right? So look at, remember when the second one in a pair is the foundational one. You have truth and error, good and evil. What happens naturally, when you're in this ignorant bottom-up mode? Error and evil. Right? If you're in a top-down mode, your starting point isn't, your limitations like error and evil. Starting point is righteousness. Right? And you have to go down to sin willfully. Right? The ones you're going up from error to truth and up from evil to goodness, but if you actually get reoriented top down so that the foundation now is above, now you start with righteousness, and you could build downward sin upon that foundation of righteousness.
As we know someone who did.
Right, as anyone who goes to sin is fundamentally doing. Genuine sin, see, can only be achieved in that top down mode. To actually get to genuine sin, deliberate disloyalty to deity, you got to get up to deity and go down, see. It isn't something about some false notion of God, some goofy notion of God, and relative to that, there's some taboo violation and you're in sin. No, no. Genuine sin can be only when you get up to the whole and begin to willfully separate yourself from the wholeness top down. See, look at how... all these things they do like that. Notice little things like that. They're trying to teach you something again. Every opportunity to get you to think of, reflect on it, right? To understand these differences better.
Chris, these choices that they're presenting in the advanced stages of light and life, are they choices that are, say even the final stages of light and life, there's still those choices that are being put before the mortal so that they can learn and make the choice. Are they choices that are being put before the mortals by seraphim, or is it just humans being humans even on advanced stages of light and life?
Again, we have a lot of people that are a long ways away from even a third circler, so there's all kinds of opportunity for humans to ignorantly be going astray and for evil to be manifest.
Even on advanced stages.
Yeah, even in advanced stages, right? And again, even with all that external help and all this sort of stuff, right? I mean, you still have an internal ignorance, right?
That can use.
Right? And of course, that's what we've been talking about as we've been, unpacking this so extensively. Just think about all of the idealistic people who have a desire for goodness, but instead what they're manifesting is evil, the opposite, right? Because of their ignorance. Right? They don't have the wisdom to take even a good motive and translate it into a true intention so that they get out what they want to get out. Right? They're flipping it on the way out of their mind into their application in the external world. Right? And that which appears to be good is bad. Right? So that's a possibility, even on the mansion world with all that incredible external help, and a Marantia mind and everything, really help you, right? None of these people have Marantia minds, remember, this is all agitated mind on a mortal world here. So even with Marantia mind and all the more help on the mansion worlds, you still can get things flipped around in your head because you don't have the requisite wisdom, right? To translate the ideal into an idea.
You know, wisdom comes from experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it takes a long time to develop that wisdom. Yeah, you can't just snap your finger and boom, I've got wisdom. Yeah.
This is all in the context of child rearing.
So yeah.
Children will be born innocent, just like they are now.
Yeah.
But they're having to get oriented in a short period of time to a much higher culture.
Yes.
Then we have to get them oriented.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. See, and you can see why you're going to need a better biologic baby for him to meet that challenge. Right? We can hardly meet the challenge of this, the limited demands of this life presents to us. I mean, imagine if we had to come up to this kind of speed, you know, in a few years.
That brings up an interesting point about the children that are raised in the probationary nurseries.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, remember, again, that's why they're raised in very tight, you know, groups and everything. Just the same thing they're saying. The same truth applies there. Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, now let's get some more here.
Nevertheless, there is a certain inevitable penalty attaching to mortal existence on such advanced evolutionary planets. When a settled world progresses beyond the third stage of light and life, all ascenders are destined, before attaining the minor sector, to receive some sort of transient assignment on a planet passing through the earlier stages of evolution.
Remember, I mentioned that before, because you know you can start to get so advanced that you don't get the requisite experience.
Right.
Right? You gotta do something else to make up for that. And notice the pattern. You know, if you flip back, remember how at the beginning they gave you the stages. You have fourth or local universe stage. Right, even though we're talking about just a planet here, but it's effectively "quote unquote" local universe stage. To go beyond the third stage. I see. So it's when you're getting in that mode of, on the bigger scale, where a local universe is settled in light and life, right, and it's kind of plugging into the super universe above. See, that's why they're saying before attaining the minor sector. Right, so I want you to just notice there. That's the level that they're getting you to think about there.
So might I understand that we do have those who are here on a transient assignment passing through an earlier stage of evolution?
Sure, yeah, there's all kinds of visitors here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there might be, like, and some of them are here for this. Yeah.
And they look like us.
No, not in that sense.
They're invisible.
Right, I mean, they're here as Marantia beings.
To do some training.
To just, to be... to experience existence in a simpler, form.
They're really as observers.
Well, it's an assignment because they didn't get it the first time.
Well, no, I mean remember, it's just they have no concept of what kind of things are in play when in a more primitive situation, and they need to actually literally immerse themselves in it and get to understand it, the interaction that goes on, so that it isn't just all theoretical to them, right?
So that would mean, and what you're saying is they're down here, for instance, even amongst us watching the dialogue.
Why did Michael do his bestowals? Because he couldn't read textbooks well? No, I mean, he knew about all that stuff, but he needs to know it experientially, right? So you have to get directly experientially involved in order for him to actually know those things.
He was one of us, but they're not going to be one of us.
No, they're not going to be corporeal, and right.
Like Jesus was.
Right. But that whole bit about, remember, we got to remember what they gave us before. You got a lot of these people that are jumping, they're fusing on their planet, jumping all the way to the local universe headquarters, and they would be scurrying off, to the minor sector in very short order, but no. Okay, they don't just come back to teach up the hierarchy,
which they do,
but they've got to do additionally, if they were so advanced, they got to do more than just teach up the hierarchy from the local system, up to the local universe headquarters. They've got to actually get to an inhabited world and, and spend some serious time there getting to understand experientially what a more primitive differential, the potentials of a more primitive differential are about.
You gotta see it to believe it.
But do they have to experience it?
Not materially.
So they're kind of experiencing it vicariously.
Personally. I mean, in the same way, do you, you know, remember you've got child rearing you got to make up for possibly, right? Do you have to literally give birth to children to make up for that in the mansion world and on Gerizim? No, right? You just work with that, the children of the material sons and daughters, right?
But you're actively involved with them.
Yeah.
That's why the question is, I think.
Well, I mean, I can't answer the question how much they might be involved. And I mean, you know, we don't even understand how much the planetary government is involved in what, you know, our day-to-day lives. Right? I mean, they're going to be involved in what's going on. I mean, they obviously are going to be intimately involved in, like, the decision-making processes of the planetary government, you know. I mean, they're going to be able to get in on all that, you know. They probably help out in, you know, in deliberations, and who knows what all they do, right? They're not going to literally be born as a babe and, you know, or anything like that.
Or incarnate.
Right, an incarnator or something, no. Right. But they're just, they're immersing themselves in it. They don't vote, he said.
I wish they would.
Okay. All right.
Visitor suffrage.
All right, okay, let's keep going here.
Each of these successive ages represents advancing achievements in all phases of planetary attainment. In the initial age of light, the revelation of truth was enlarged to embrace the workings of the universe of universes, while the deity study of the second age is the attempt to master the protean concept of the nature, mission, ministry, associations, origin, and destiny of the Creator Sons, the first level of God the Sevenfold.
Okay, so remember the planetary mortal epics, right? You were, you know, you're going from local system, constellation, local universe, super universe, and central universe. Okay, now when you get to light and life, okay, you go to, you know, the whole grand universe, the universe of universes. That's the next step after getting the central universe. And then the next step after that, like they're saying, is you're going to start working up, trying to understand deity up the levels of God the Sevenfold. You notice how, see, that while the deity study and then the first level of God the Sevenfold, right, this is philosophy, right? You're actually studying deity, total deity, right? Like we, you know, start to work on here. But you know, you're starting simple. You know, to understand God the Sevenfold. God the Sevenfold, you know, the Sevenfold, that facet of deity is very complicated, very hard to understand. See, and they're pointing out even on the lowest level how complicated it is. Now they're just mentioning Creator Sons, but you got everything else, of course, on that first level too. Creator, Mother Spirits, and the power beings on that level, you know, Master Physical Controllers. Okay, the protean concept, right? They're trying to get you to remember that, you know, you get it all figured out in your local universe, but every local universe is a totally different story. Right? Scratch all, you know, erase all the things, everything you learned, you got to start all over again with the next local universe. Okay, you have this incredibly variable, remember Proteus, you know, Greek god, you know, is a shapeshifter, right? So, you're trying to, you know, so you get the universe of universes, so then in that context, you can start to try to get all the details of all 700,000 local universes and then try to transcend that into, synthesize that into a recognition of the unity inherent in that 700,000-fold diversity so that you can get at the deity of that.
No wonder you need teacher sons.
Okay. Right. To transcend all of that individuality and all that differential, to get the unity that is the deity that is common in all of that. Right? The sevenfold deity that's inherent in that diversity from the individuality viewpoint. What if you're trying to be able to take all of that individuality viewpoint and flip it around and get the unity viewpoint and get the deity? Right? And of course, that's just the beginning of trying to grok that deity that's called the sevenfold. Right? Okay, that's what they're getting at. Let's see. I got to think about this. I'm trying to decide if we should. Let's see if we. Yeah, it might be just too rushed. It probably is too rushed to penetrate through this. Why don't we just? Why don't we stop it there for the night, and we'll pick up the rest of that next time, because with all, we can't just read through those 7 points. So we don't want to push that too hard. Okay, so let's just expand on this a little bit more, and then we'll wrap it up. You can obviously guess where this is going to go. If I'm working on, here, let's look at it for a second. If you pull up the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart, notice on my chart here, it's not God the sevenfold, or it's the sevenfold, right? I'm actually presenting this in that mode of thought, that facet of deity. Right, so you're starting by working on this, cosmic level number one here. With the creative mother spirits, the master physical controllers, and the master creator sons. Okay, and you're trying to synthesize a very extensive, in-depth recognition of all of that diversity, all of that individuality. Can you get above all of that, so that you can begin to synthesize all that and, turn around and begin to look at that from the top down, from the unity viewpoint, rather than the initial bottom-up individuality viewpoint of all that protean diversity, right? And then, obviously, if I'm doing that in the second stage, where I'm going in the third stage of light and life, I'm just going to start moving up the ladder here, and I'm going to try to build up, and we'll see that as we go forward into the next section, that you're obviously going to be building up and trying to get as much of a recognition of the nature of the sevenfold when you have not yet actually ascended up through that, right? You're getting a foretaste of the feast to come, while you're still on your nativity sphere, of how you're working up through the sevenfold. When you remember that when you're finding the universal father on the third circuit of Avona, right? You've worked up to the top level. You're finding the universal father in the sevenfold. Right? You can't find the universal father. You have no way to get at him directly. Right? You can only get the universal father through the downstepped deity that is the sevenfold in that context. So that's what they're talking about here, is actually beginning to have a world that is so advanced that you can begin to have experiences and understanding on that world that normally you would have had to have ascended, up a long ways to be able to have the scope, to encompass. Right? But you're starting to bring more and more of heaven down to earth, see? Bigger and bigger scopes of heaven can actually be expressed on an earth as you move forward in these stages of light and life. Right? So to think about it in that different way, not just, when you're in the Trinity teacher son age, that you're learning about the central universe, but that's a world that can actually embody in its social nature and everything, the essence of the central universe brought down to earth. Obviously, it's a far cast shadow, right? But nonetheless, see, that's, it's not, you're able to experience that some, it's like we were just talking about with those visitors to another planet. You're not just learning about something. You're literally beginning to be of it to some degree, at least in truth. You know, obviously, you're not of the central universe in fact, yet you're a long ways away from, you know, heading off from Universa and going to the central universe. Right? But that's, that, you know, to remember there's none of this, all the whole point of the revelation is that things can be literalized, be made experientially tangible, right? Like we were just, you know, we talked about originalness of the spirit. Spirit is not just some abstract concept of no substance. No, it's a substance. Reality. Yeah, it eventually, you can grab it and squeeze it. Right, it's tangible. You can measure the amount of altruism to as many decimal places, you know, as your measuring device, you know, is precise to. I mean, these all these things are literal, 5.68 units of altruism. Right, you know, 5.4 units of goodness, etc.
But right? Still, in such a world of beauty, have such consistent expressions of sin to afford.
Right, you have to have the differential. Right, yeah. You know, we fundamentally exist in the actualization of the universal absolute. And if you think about it from the individuality viewpoint, you exist in the actualization of that reservoir, the differential reservoir. Right, you can't. There is only experience in that domain. You can't experience the endpoints. The material substance, you know, and the spirit substance. All you can experience is mind. You can experience representations of matter in mind. You can experience representations of spirit in mind. You can't experience either directly, the reality of either directly. You only have access to the appearance of the representation in your mind. Right? And where does that mind come from? Right? Out of the universal absolute reservoir. Right? And that, you know, not only is it the reservoir of mind, but it's a reservoir of that tension, that differential. You fundamentally exist in that differential. That's until there's a differential, there isn't understanding is not possible. Right, so, you know, this the fallacy of a religious worldview that seeks to transcend the differential. That's to transcend reality. There is no transcending it. You know, you're inescapably in it. You don't try to avoid the tension, you know, by dumbing down your mind or something to a more primitive state that doesn't have that tension. No, you have to find the courage to face that tension. It's in that tension that your life exists. Right? To find a way to will that tension away is to die. Right. Right. So that, you know, that's just so at odds, you know, from what a lot of worldviews have always taught. Anyway, that's so, you know, when we get more into it, you know, we can, you know, remind ourselves to touch back on that and notice how they give little passing comments about moving up those levels and trying to get more and more holistic recognition of exactly what this facet of deity is. It's called the sevenfold. Very, very difficult facet of deity to comprehend. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.